We've preempted today's Sunshine Economy to bring you a Miami Herald WLRN special. Innocence Lost, Town Hall. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. What does it mean to be a six-year-old in Florida? You'd probably be finishing up your kindergarten year in school, beginning to learn how to read. Maybe you have soccer or t-ball practice, learning to swim, playing games, growing up. That was not the life of Joshua Jenkins. He showed up in school with cuts and bruises and broken bones. Every injury had an explanation for teachers and DCF investigators. In 2006, when Joshua was asked about his injuries, he told authorities, quote, "Daddy did it." Teachers told investigators Joshua did not want to go home after school, that he appeared to be scared of his mom and stepfather. The DCF closed a subsequent investigation, finding no suspected abuse of any kind. 2 years later, in 2008, Joshua died from blunt force trauma. His stepfather, Philip Gale, is serving 30 years for aggravated manslaughter. Joshua is just one of 477 Florida children who had contact with the Department of Children and Families who died of abuse or neglect since 2008. During the town hall, we will hear from the agency, from lawmakers and community organizers. First, we hear from the two reporters who led the Miami Herald's investigation, Carol Marvin Miller and Audra Birch.
Carol, Joshua's story, like the 477 stories, all tragic, all with their own awful circumstances. But was there a systemic breakdown?
When we interviewed Secretary Jacobo at DCF a couple of months ago, she acknowledged that the facts of this case were not appropriate, that they were not defensible, and I don't think there's anyone here in the room who would seek to defend what happened to that little boy. But we also found that it was illustrative of a much broader problem within Florida, and that is that we shifted policy towards something called family preservation, where a premium is placed on keeping families together to the extent that you can, because, as we know, foster care is not the best place to grow up, and of course, nobody in child welfare, no one who works within social services wants to flood any state with foster children. What Florida did wrong, and again, Secretary Jacobo acknowledged this, was that we shifted toward this policy very rigorously before ensuring that we had adequate services in place to mitigate the risk that such children as Joshua faced. And by that I mean, if you are going to leave an infant or a toddler with a mother who has been a drug addict for 10 years and is still actively using dangerous drugs, you would want to ensure that that mother is actively engaged in drug treatment. We weren't doing that. We were closing cases. We were leaving children like Joshua in harm's way. And what we found is implementing this policy in that fashion turned out to be very dangerous for Florida children, especially the youngest among them, infants and toddlers who were not capable of speaking out in their own defense, who couldn't ask for help, who couldn't run away. Those children died at a far greater rate than their older siblings.
And in fact, Audra, most of the kids in the cases that you detail were younger than 3 years old.
We had children like Kyla Joy Hall was 8 months old when she died. She was beaten to death by her father, who's now serving a life term. You had Emmanuel Lewis, who was thrown out of a moving car, and he was also an infant. These are clearly people who are children who are not able to get the help that they need. There were a number of trends that started to emerge as we studied these cases. Another one is that two-thirds of those cases were linked to drug and alcohol abuse. And what we know is that a home in which you have parents who are either abusing drugs or alcohol and not receiving the appropriate treatment is a home that has risk. And we even had cases where the child would actually die of the very drug that the parent was abusing. Oxycodone, for instance, was one of the big ones that came up over and over again. The other thing that we found was that the safety promises that were used to try to stabilize these homes were not effective because you didn't have, in too many of the cases, meaningful follow-up. So it's not enough to ask a parent to not do something or to be a better parent if you don't have the people and the resources in place to be able to monitor it and to make sure that whatever it is that we're asking you to do is getting done. And if that's not the case, then DCF has the power to compel the parent to order services.
Audra, the criteria you used, where did that come from?
We used the criteria of both DCF, which, you know, how they determine family history, but then we also use the federal regulation, which is the 5-year window that they use to measure deaths.
Pete DeGree is the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Children and Families. Welcome, Pete. Thank you for coming to the town hall. Grainne O'Sullivan is the Director of Children's Legal Services for the agency as well. Thank you for your time. Pete, were these deaths preventable?
Many of them were, just as simple as that. And I think there's been several problems, some of which we think we've come away in solving, and some of them are still not totally solved. I think first and foremost, this is a terrific series. And frankly, in reading it very carefully, I don't find an awful lot to debate with the Miami Herald.
Were you shocked by the results?
No, not at all, because we've done similar studies. We had the analytic group SAS come in and do a very, very comprehensive review, and frankly, their data ties just about perfectly to the Herald's data. And what's so striking to me is what I really love about this series is I'm the guy who reviews these cases. And what you've done is you put names and faces out to the public so the public can understand what a serious and devastating problem this is. I mean, there's as I look at it, I see several things. I see a little bit less of the trying to keep families intact because safety has always been the priority. I've never heard anybody say that safety is a secondary priority to family preservation. However, what I have seen is an awful lot of is child protective investigators and case managers with too much work to do. Right now, today, in Miami, the average CPI has 18 cases. So the single most important thing that can be done is to adopt the governor's recommendations, which gets our child protective investigators on the whole to a caseload of 10 families, which is still too high. I'm telling you, in Los Angeles, it's 7.5. In New York, it's 5.
What kind of budget would it take to get to that kind of caseload here in the state of Florida?
The governor has proposed a $40 million effort to build CPIs.
The findings from the Herald investigation, what Carol and Audra detailed, the 477 verified deaths of abuse and neglect. You say you weren't surprised or shocked by that, that matched what you had a third party see. What kind of internal accounting is done when it comes to child deaths at DCF?
Well, it goes through a process both internally, where we have a death review of coordinators. I personally look at each and every one of them in some detail. And it also goes to an interagency team in each of the circuits and eventually up to the state death review team.
Is there the kind of accounting, however, that the Herald did in terms of the gathering together of the cases so you can see a whole picture as opposed to 477 individual tragedies?
No, absolutely. I mean, that's what I'm talking about with the SAS study, and we had the Casey Foundation do the same thing. And the conclusions, the Herald's conclusions, the Casey conclusions, and our own conclusions are all pretty similar. Frankly, our staff were running on a methodology that was developed in the late 80s. With very little change, although, over those 25 years or so. So we built this new methodology, and we built it right into our computers so we can track every action and are busy rolling it out. Probably the most important part of this is we now have the safety plan nailed down, hardwired in our computer system, and the safety plan is required to be stated in verifiable terms. It requires a monitoring protocol, and you've got to go back and keep verifying it to making sure it's working. And the single most important thing, and this comes up in case after case after case, You can't walk away based on a bunch of family promises. We worked with our substance abuse system, and now we built right into the computer, hardwired it, where the substance abuse providers have to, we have an alert system, and if somebody drops out of treatment, they just push, check a little box, and it immediately sends notification to either the CPI or the case manager that we've got a person failed. Just in the month of March, I was just looking at this data, we got 832 alerts that people had either dropped out or were failing placement. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is we had about 2,500 alerts that people were doing pretty well.
Grainne, let me ask you about the teeth that you and your lawyers have when it comes to court and this family preservation philosophy. Number one, does that philosophy still persist today?
No, absolutely not. The paramount thing here is that the child's safe, and whatever that's going to take, we at Legal have to work with our PIs really to develop the evidence and help them to gather the evidence so that we can bring petitions to court.
Would you like to see more teeth in the safety plans in court?
Court-ordered
safety plans, and what would it take for your team of attorneys to be able to adjudicate that if that was the case from the legislature?
Well, I agree 100% with the safety plans and what Carol was saying about them and Pete. We cannot rely on parental promises. These parents are the very ones that are creating these issues, and to rely on them to say, I promise that I'm not going to use drugs, or I promise that I'm not going to go back to the person that's been my abuser, it just doesn't make any practical kind of common sense.
Pete, you mentioned the governor's increased budget proposal for the next budget cycle of $40 million, $39 million. Mm-hmm. Being debated in the House and Senate, obviously, in terms of specifics. There's also been talk of upwards of 400 investigators. What kind of resources would a $40 million bump in the agency budget mean for the agency?
Well, It's a huge deal. I mean, as I said, it really does two things. It takes our current trend lines, and it brings our CPIs to not having more than 10 families in any given time. That is still, as I said, a big amount of work. That's at least 20 children they're responsible for, but it's a lot better than it is today.
How many caseworkers is that new?
Well, I'll tell you exactly. For getting to 10 to 1, it's 164 new CPIs. For doing the pairing up with the kids under 4 with the drugs, violence, physical abuse, mm-hmm. the population we're talking about here, it's 193, and then 59 supervisors.
The package that the governor has put forth is for $39 million, and $8 million of that would go towards the sheriff's offices. But what it does not appear to address at this point is services. What we know and what we've been told in all of these studies is that we have a gap in services. Thus far, we have not seen any of the proposals come forth that are ascribing a significant amount of money to the very social services that are needed to mitigate the risk and stabilize the homes.
Once your investigator has determined that a child is at risk, you have to do something to stabilize the situation of that child. And to do that, you have to refer the case to a case manager at a community-based care agency. And unless you just want to go through the motions, you have to provide services and supervision. And that is the side of the equation that the current legislation does not address. Drug treatment for parents with addictions, mental health care for parents with chronic and severe mental illnesses such as schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, which are by definition a risk to children. Domestic violence shelters that help women make the changes in their behavior that enable them to no longer be at risk by continually going back to men who abuse them and also abuse their children. Those services must be restored, and I say restored because over the years, since the Great Recession, they've all been declining. And what we've done in the past several years that we know doesn't work is to say we will leave these children with parents on their promise to improve their behavior, but with no meaningful services to protect the children. And I think everyone in this room now agrees that that doesn't work.
Pete, as Deputy Secretary of DCF, your message to the community about whether or not children tonight are safer in troubled homes in Florida?
I have no doubt that they're safer because of the improvements in the safety plan, the bringing substance abuse into the computer system with the alerts, with rolling out the safety methodology, and with other improvements. I'm seeing good results of this. We still have a horrendously high level of deaths of kids where there's been some involvement. However, it's been steadily decreasing since about, it sort of peaked in about 2009, 2010, and has been going down a little bit, nowhere near what it should be, but a little bit.
Carol, respond to that.
I feel like I have to, and Secretary DeGree and I go back a long way, and I respect you immensely, but I don't respect your data on this point, because what there are several things that we know. We know, number one, that the agency has been chronically and routinely undercounting the deaths, and that occurs for a variety of reasons, one of which is that a case can remain pending for many months, indeed for years. But there are other things that are going on that we would suggest also render the data unreliable. And one of the things that happened was around 2010, a very deliberate decision was made to tweak the definition of what it is to die from neglect in Florida. Two of the largest categories of child abuse or neglect-related deaths are drownings and what are called co-sleepings, in which a parent places a child in an adult bed or in a crib under conditions which are unsafe, and the child unfortunately perishes. And what Florida did around 2010 was change the definition of a neglect death such that if you did not deliberately intend to willfully neglect your child, it doesn't count. So if I go home tonight, take a bunch of drugs, put my kid in bed with me, knowing that it's unsafe, roll over on her and kill her, it won't count.
Deputy Secretary, respond to the change in definition of neglect death.
Yeah.
And the delay in classifying some clearly commonsensical causes of death being abuse.
Yeah.
And the impact on the data that you're citing.
What we did is we got explicit that if parents, in fact, are using drugs or in any way negligent, it is, in fact, something that we verify. So actually, as a percentage of reported deaths, the numbers that we verified actually went up. And, you know, after the allegation matrix was redefined, we verify a higher percentage of the reported deaths than we did previously.
Pete DeGree, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Children and Families at the Miami Herald WLRN Innocence Lost Town Hall. Still to come, the Herald investigation hits just as lawmakers meet for the 2014 session. What can be done to the state's child protection laws and policies? This is a Miami Herald WLRN special, Innocence Lost, Town Hall. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. In 2002 and in 2011, the Department of Children and Families had been the focus of reform efforts. The 2014 state legislative session also is debating reforms to Florida's child protection policies. We continue with the Town Hall with Mary Ellen Kloss, who covers the legislature for the Miami Herald.
Both the House and the Senate have done some very, very impressive work putting together two bills that are very comprehensive in looking at changing the way the state deals with child abuse investigations particularly. And just a brief summary of some of this, because remember, we've got 2 weeks left, so that means that there's a big chance they will be changed. The Senate's bill is going through a very substantial rewrite as we speak. But the bottom line is that the goal is to really improve the quality of child abuse investigations. And by increasing the qualifications of the child abuse investigators, they use the term professionalizing the industry. There is some provisions to give higher education requirements, offer some education rebates and loans to incentivize people to get these higher degrees. There is a lot of work being done in the bills to direct DCF to do, as the Secretary mentioned, this immediate investigation to give the agency more feedback and significant feedback in terms of what's happening, where are their patterns, and are there things that they can do to perhaps change policy quickly. There is also some reporting requirements, additional efforts to kind of root out the causes and rapidly determine some of the reasons that these child abuse deaths are occurring. And there's also a provision to address something where the state is now facing a lawsuit, and that is dealing with medically complex children. That's just a very highlight of a 200-page bill.
It's a long bill. It's a long laundry list of goals and, some would argue, opportunities for reform. What's different this time, though? In 2002, then-Governor Bush convened a blue ribbon panel. In 2011, there was an internal review within DCF that led to more than two dozen different internal reforms. What's different this time?
As far as I'm concerned, it's the same in that they are words on a piece of paper. And what's going to change is the effort to put the meat behind the words. And that, I think, will evidence itself in where they put money.
The legislators who are joining us, welcome to both of you. Democratic Senator Eleanor Sobel, thank you so much, ma'am, for joining us. And Republican Representative Eric Frezen. Senator, let me begin with you. To Mary Ellen's point, where are you going to put the money?
We're going to put the money where it's needed. I believe that there will be money put for the CPIs, that there will be money put into services. We're looking at the budget side by side with the governor's recommendations, the House's recommendations. I believe that the Senate president and Senate leadership, including myself, which is a bipartisan effort, are going to do the right thing by the children of Florida.
The Senate proposal calls for $33.5 million. How much of that would you like to go to investigators, and how much of it would you like to go and directed towards services?
That's a very good question. I don't know where you got the number $33 million, because the Senate president has not yet made the allocation to DCF.
What would you like that allocation to be?
Oh, I'd like it to be at least $50 million. I'd like to go for the highest number I could possibly get, because there is definitely a demand for services. There's definitely a demand for professionalization of the staff of DCF, and it needs to have a thorough revamping and change at this particular time.
Representative Frezen, the $50 million hopeful figure that Senator Sobel mentioned would restore half of the cuts that the agency saw this fiscal year. Are you willing to support that number?
I'm willing to support whatever number those that actually know about this issue a little bit more than I do think is the right number. What I can tell you is this, that whether it's $50 million or $40 million, any amount of money improperly appropriated and improperly spent really doesn't do anything. So I think, to Carol's point, I think when you look at this issue and you realize how layered it is and you see how complex it is, even when it comes to budgeting, it's not all about the department. So when you start looking at services for drug addiction, for spousal abuse, there are a lot of portions in the budget that also provide funding for those services. I know for a fact in the Health and Human Services budget that's separate from the DCF budget, we've put additional dollars for domestic violence treatment centers and drug addiction centers. So I would like to see what the allocations end up looking like in its totality and not just to the department, because I think the department's focus should be the professionalization of the services and of the caseworkers themselves, who are the first line of defense. But I don't think it's all about throwing a bunch of money at the department when at the end of the day, a lot of these services that should be provided aren't really in the purview of the department's responsibility. So it's impossible for me to tell you whether or not 30, 40, 50, or 100 million is the right number, but I think it's definitely whatever ends up getting appropriated, whatever the Senate President or the Speaker allocate for this portion, let's make sure that we distribute it in the way that will provide the most reliable services that are needed for these families.
Senator Sobel, from your perspective, the family preservation as a philosophy, does that need to be addressed in policy from the legislature?
Absolutely, it needs to be addressed in policy. And one of the biggest issues that I've been focusing on is the quality of the workforce. There's tremendous turnover in DCF, which was not addressed previously. The morale is low. And one of the issues I focused on was the who are the people working for DCF? There are a lot of do-gooders. People believe that they can make a difference with our kids. I believe that we should have more social workers who are actually skilled to help us with these very, very difficult problems.
So now, to be clear, Senator, you would like to require a certain percentage of caseworkers to have a college degree in social work?
Yes. Yes.
And is the funding there to attract the quality of the workforce that would be necessary for those degreed candidates to find that job financially attractive?
Well, just like firefighters fight fires, social workers deal with social issues.
I am less convinced that we need to go to that model than I am convinced that we need to find a way to encourage critical thinking among frontline workers. By that I mean, you cannot take a child who has sustained a depressed skull fracture, as Logan Hancock did a few months ago, and place that child back in the home of his mother and father with a safety plan that says that the mother and father can't leave the child with anyone else, when you know that the mother and father were the two prime suspects in cracking the baby's skull. About a month or two after that child was returned, his skull was cracked again, and he died. And a person who is extremely well-versed in critical thinking, a person who has the ability to stand up to his or her attorney, a person who has the ability to stand up to his or her boss, a person who has the ability to shout from the rooftop without regard to the consequences that a baby will never be safe when given back to the person who cracked his skull. That is the person that I want in that job.
Reporter Carol Marvin Miller at the Miami Herald, WLRN, Innocence Lost, Town Hall. Still to come, more on the legislative response to the investigation, decisions about how dollars are to be spent. We've preempted today's Sunshine Economy to bring you a Miami Herald WLRN special, Innocence Lost, Town Hall. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Governor Rick Scott wants the state legislature to approve spending $40 million additional dollars with the Department of Children and Families. We continue our conversation now with Carol Marvin Miller and Mary Ellen Kloss of the Miami Herald, Representative Eric Frezen, and Senator Eleanor Sobel.
Will the budget sustain the proposals and the policy changes that are inside that Senate bill?
It's a very good question. I think it will.
You think it will?
I think it will.
Representative?
I hope.
You hope it will.
Mm-hmm.
Carol, from your reporting, where should Florida be looking for best practices of child welfare systems?
We deployed Audra to Alabama during the course of this investigation because over the course of many years we had been told, to our great surprise, given what we thought we knew about Alabama, that they had one of the best child welfare systems in the country. The reason that they have one of the best child welfare systems in the country is that they were sued back when you could sue. You can't anymore. And as a result of that lawsuit, a court monitor was put in place and a plan of action was implemented. And many of the things that we talked about in this series that went wrong no longer go wrong there. And some of the things we suggested could be done better are going on there. including lower caseloads, no promissory note safety plans. One of the things that Audra was told that we thought was fascinating was that when a child protective investigator goes out to investigate a report of abuse and discovers that a violent paramour, the child welfare word for boyfriend or girlfriend, is living in the home, big, big red flag is raised, and everyone has to attend to that red flag. We're aware of that here, and as we wrote in the series, Mr. DeGree wrote a memo about it a long time ago, and he's been talking about it ever since.
Representative Fresen, how will we know when Florida's children are protected better?
Part of the reason why I use the word hope instead of think that it will as far as the budget is because I think you could lay out, and I do think that both plans, and Senator Sobel has done an amazing job in putting together that very complex bill. I think you can always say, well, this is the plan, this is the bill, and we will fund it, and I think you can. But if the problem and the systemic issue is deeper than a specific plan, then to answer, will $40 million solve it, or will it fund that bill, or will $100 million or $30 million fund it, that's where I use the word hope. And again, I think that the next evolution of this conversation has to be to empower DCF and the front line to be able to make more commonsensical decisions. And by that, Carol quoted the fact that two-thirds of these cases have drug addiction involved in them. So to the extent that we can start recognizing that addiction is an inherent danger, regardless of any other telltale signs around it, recognizing that, yes, parenting is a right, but it also brings an incredible responsibility. And if you're removing that responsibility because of your addiction, we should treat that addicted person. We shouldn't incarcerate them. But we certainly should recognize, especially at the youngest ages, that addiction is an inherent danger to a child. Let's go ahead and solve some of these issues, empower DCF, empower the system to keep these kids safe.
Senator Sobel, when will you be convinced that the system works for Florida's most vulnerable kids?
Child welfare is not only a Florida problem, it's a worldwide problem. I'm a believer in the grassroots. I believe that you sitting out here know what's going on in your community. And you need to tell your representatives, your senators, the DCF, what changes need to be accomplished. I will tell you that I could not believe that Broward County had the largest number of deaths. I thought we had a good program up in Broward County, and I'm from Broward. What I really found out was, and the connection that I made, was that we had the largest number of pill mills.
Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald. You cover Tallahassee. You have both houses represented here to your left, both parties represented to your left. Your thoughts on what you've heard about the policy prescriptions?
Tallahassee's very far away, and it's really far from Miami. But these kinds of discussions and the feedback that comes from very engaged people like you down here really can make an effect. There's 2 weeks left of the session, and right now the state is in a situation where it has more money than it's had in 7 years. There is a budget surplus, and they're making choices. The question to me, and I think that the question those of you who care can ask and can be asked of legislators as they're putting their budget together, is what kind of choices are they going to make for children and going forward? That is evident to me when we see the draft budgets between the House and the Senate, and they're loaded with a lot of local projects. There's things like a $10 million tower for downtown Miami. If it's easy to finance a $10 million high-rise in Miami, can you find $25 million to put money into services?
Mary Ellen Kloss covers the state legislature for the Miami Herald. Carol Marvin Miller, thank you so much with the Miami Herald. Senator Sobel, thank you for joining us here. And Representative Fresen, thank you so much for your comments.
Still to come as the town hall continues, neighbors, friends, family, missing the signs of abuse, ignoring the signs of abuse. What is a community's responsibility? This is a Miami Herald WLRN special, Innocence Lost, Town Hall. I'm Tom Hudson. The 477 children who had contact with the Florida Department of Children and Families before they died of abuse or neglect all had neighbors, grandparents, aunts, uncles, teachers, coaches. Some may have seen the signs of abuse and reported it. Some may have not. Some may have ignored the signs, hoping for the best. We continue with our town hall, our community conversation, with Audra Birch of the Miami Herald.
Did you uncover cases which, upon hindsight, the abuse, the neglect that seemed so obvious in hindsight, was merely accepted by those who saw it?
Absolutely. I would like to start this segment with a story about a little boy named Aiden, who is from Palm Bay, who was beaten to death by his mother's boyfriend while she was at work. And in the course of the DCF investigation, which was the death review, and the police both identified six different witnesses who had seen some form of abuse against this little boy. And so you have to ask yourself the question, if just one of them had made the phone call, could the outcome have been different? And so one of the great challenges that the agency faces is having people participate. And one of the issues that the agency faces is, and the community faces, is changing the culture of acceptance, that it's okay to pick up the phone. If we're talking about reducing that number, that 477, or preventing further deaths, then you have to pick up the phone. In case after case, after the death, and during the investigation, the grandmother says, yeah, I saw it, but I didn't want the kid taken because I didn't want to lose my grandson or my granddaughter. And frankly, it's irresponsible because in the end, these were death reviews. That means you already lost your grandson or your granddaughter.
There's a trio next to you, Audra, that are vigorously agreeing with you as you talk about this. Dr. Walter Lambert is the medical director of the University of Miami Child Protection Team. Doctor, thank you for joining us. Kurt Kelly is the CEO of Florida Coalition of Children, and Hillary Camber is the director of legal training for the Guardian Ad Litem program. Kurt and Hillary, thank you. Hillary, to the point of culture of acceptance, what's the right way to speak up?
Any way is the right way to speak up, as far as I'm concerned, loudly and often to anyone who will listen. There isn't a magic way. We all know what's the right thing to do, and we do it in any way we can. We can speak to a teacher. They're mandated reporters. We can speak to a medical professional. We could pick up the phone and call the hotline. We could call the Guardian Ad Litem program. We could call, I mean, they're just more ways than I can list tonight.
Dr. Lambert, is it easy to spot? Is it easy to spot an injury, an abuse versus an innocent injury?
I think we really have to, I want to say this straight out. There is no doubt in the last 4 or 5 years there have been more reports to the hotline than we've had before. One of the problems with funding is if we have, we already hit around 100,000. I think yesterday we were at 99,000. So what does that mean if we go the same way? We're at 300,000. Last year we did like 265, we 150. There are many more reports to the hotline than there used to be. And one of the problems with funding is that means there's more reports for the protective investigators to go out. But unfortunately, during these last years, reports went up, but funding went down. Our law says any resident, any person who knows or has suspicion should report. And there are many, many reports from the community. I do agree there are people who see stuff and don't report. There are family members who don't report. But that's not the norm. We have lots of reports. The problem is we have lots of reports, mm-hmm. and then we have to have good investigations.
You're certainly not discouraging reporting because there's large.
Even compared to, and I will say this, I call in reports, you wait less now than you did mm-hmm. 10 years ago, for sure. It's a faster system. The truth of the matter is the system is, it's relatively responsive.
What's the armchair ability to tell the difference between an abuse injury and an innocent one?
Well, I think let's start. The law says if you suspect child maltreatment, you're supposed to call it in. In Florida, we're actually relatively unique that we actually have within our statute a network of teams that cover every geographical area, theoretically in Florida, the child protection teams. And in the series, there were many cases, as pointed out, the child protection team had said that it was child maltreatment, and then a decision was made afterwards to either ignore that or not. And in the funding issues, that's one of those that has not been addressed.
The measure of a civilized society is probably how we take care of our most vulnerable, particularly children. I'm fairly philosophical about this. You know, I went to Florida State University, political science, studied all that philosophy and stuff. And it really comes to bear when I've taken this position to be able to understand that the things that that the legislators are making, the decisions that Senator Sobel, my dear friend Eric Frezen, who we served together, the decisions that they're making actually get to support that securing the blessing of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, the protection of children. I truly believe that as a society, we ought to be pained. We ought to be deeply pained when we read these articles.
Kurt Kelly of the Florida Coalition for Children. Still to come, a community takes responsibility as the Miami Herald WLRN Innocence Lost Town Hall continues. Today's Sunshine Economy has been preempted to bring you a Miami Herald WLRN special, Innocence Lost Town Hall. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. The Herald series on hundreds of kids dying from abuse or neglect despite contact with state child welfare authorities has been a lightning rod for calls to action. What can a community do? We continue the town hall with Audra Birch of the Miami Herald.
What does your investigation inform you about the process of reporting suspected child abuse and neglect in the state of Florida?
I think the most important finding and the most important thing moving forward is when you make the phone call, the information that you are giving to them, it has to be full enough to give them enough to chase, so to speak. So you want to be able to say, if it's possible, the name and the address and the age, the suspected abuse, as full a description as that you can give that you're comfortable with, so that they have something to chase. In some cases, they're screened out because there's just simply not enough information. So as much information as you can give, and you can do that anonymously to the hotline, then that gives them the tools to chase these cases.
I believe in the front row we have a representative from the Broward Sheriff's Office. Is that right? Jim Walker, second row. Jim Walker's with the BSO, the Administration for Child Protective Investigations. Mr. Walker, from your experiences in the process of the public being able to identify and report suspected child abuse and neglect, what are the best practices that you encounter in the field and practices that come up short?
In Broward County, the Broward County school system has a designated child abuse designee in every school. And so therefore, every school has a mandated person within the school, each school, to talk to the teachers. The Broward County School Board has the Sheriff's Office once a year do a training of at least one representative of every school. In Broward County, we met at Broward College this past week. The week before, we met at Florida FAU. And I believe one of the things is within each community, we need to go out and have meetings like this, whether it be with college students, public school teachers, judiciary, explaining to them abuse and neglect reports. Broward County has 45% fewer children than Miami-Dade, but Broward County gets more abuse reports than Miami-Dade because we get out there and tell people to report the suspicion.
Thank you, Jim. Jim Walker with the Broward Sheriff's Office. Hillary Camber with the Guardian Ad Litem program, you work with a crew of thousands of volunteers that come into the process, into the judicial process.
The result on our program of the Innocence Lost, our phones have been ringing off the hook.
You recently announced 9,000 volunteers.
Over 9,000 volunteers statewide, representing over 22,000 children.
And how many are needed?
Sorry?
How many are needed?
Many, many more. We're at about 84% statewide representation. We train our volunteers in how to investigate their children's cases, how to work with social welfare system, with lawyers, with judges. They are not the risk assessors. That is not their job. Their job is to visit children, see where they live, talk to everybody in their lives, their teachers, their doctors, their therapists, their caretakers, their parents. and report those facts to the court, the eyes and ears of the court.
Kurt, you heard the numbers legislators were talking about. You know the budgetary increase that the agency is in line for if the legislation passes the House and the Senate. We don't know the mix between boots on the ground with investigators with the agency and community services.
Yeah, and let me say this. Let's talk about boots on the ground with CPIs. Very critical. We've always been supportive of that. We think that's important that you've got to get that right up front. We've always spoken toward that. We believe that we thank the governor and his staff and DCF for supporting that. But that doesn't go far enough because, quite frankly, when they go in there and they make the decision that they're going to take the child and have the child removed, they get it through the dependency system, or if they're going to try to provide services for the family, who's going to provide those services? We have actually had less money put into our system, and we have less money today than we had in 2007.
What are the priorities in terms of this community services?
The average caseworker was handling around 55 cases. 55 to 1, ridiculous. Children were getting lost. We are now down to about 17 to 20. But the national norm should be between 12 and 15. We want to focus there. We think that's the right thing to do.
You've heard a lot of responsibility in this room, in this town hall. Certainly the comments that you've heard from the reporting of Innocence Lost, you've heard a community that is standing up and getting involved and taking responsibility. So for those of us who can hear you, your recommendation for this community so that innocence is found?
I would say don't forget. Don't let this be the last time that you discuss the 477, but much, much more importantly, that you don't forget what we need to do to make sure there's not another 477.
Audra Birch of the Miami Herald, who along with Carol Marvin Miller were the two investigative reporters for the Miami Herald on the series Innocence Lost. This town hall was recorded in front of a live audience at the Miami Herald headquarters in Doral on April 17th. For more from the town hall, including video, you can visit miamiherald.com or wlrn.org. The town hall was produced by Elaine Chen. The audio engineer for live audio was Krista Angeles. The Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. The live event was organized by Nancy San Martin of the Miami Herald. We preempted the Sunshine Economy today to bring you this Miami Herald WLRN special, Innocence Lost Town Hall. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.